Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, healthcare and science, discussions, dialogue, maybe a few diatribes, and, oh yes, elephant talk. No, I'm kidding. It's Ask Dr. Dawn, and welcome. So if you have a question, you can call us, and I'll give out those numbers in a little while. And if you're listening on podcast, you can go to askdrdawn.com and email, and we may use your question in a subsequent show. So, before we go any further, I do need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors, or any other entity that might exist. And the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. There were a lot of interesting stories in the news. There are two, however, I thought I would sort of use to throw out the ball, and that is ALS caused by a retrovirus. That was the headline, and indeed, this is some very, very interesting research. Especially because this article contained a statistic that I found astonishing. 8% of the human genome consists of what are probably ancient retroviruses, which are non-mammalian DNA that has incorporated itself into the genome. And some of this probably goes back to viruses that existed in the Australopithecine times and got incorporated into Lucy and passed down to us, so to speak. Now, ALS is a very, very terrible disease that causes people to become paralyzed, knocks out the motor neurons in the spine, and it affects approximately 30,000 people in the United States at the moment. About half of these people die within 3 years. Only 10% of ALS patients survive beyond 8 years. And only about a fifth of these cases can be accounted for by heredity. So cases, most of them just arise out of the blue. What these researchers were doing was looking for retroviruses, and they looked in the brains of people with ALS who had died. And in doing so, they found just in the areas of the brain that were part of the motor cortex, the areas that would be involved in those long track neurons, the origin, in other words, of those long track neurons in your spinal cord is all the way up in the brain. And they found a large number of copies of something called human endogenous retrovirus K. And they found large amounts of that exclusively in the motor cortex of the brain in patients with ALS. So this could be, and I want to emphasize that could be the beginnings of a functional therapy. It is certainly a marker that if it proves to be replicatable by other studies and other researchers, because there's always the possibility of laboratory contamination or some other mess up here in research like this. But if it turns out to be real, it was present only in the neurons, not in the glial cells, not in the astrocytes, not in the other cells. So it could be real. And if it's real, it provides us with the possibility that antiretroviral drugs that target HERV-V could actually make a difference in ALS. So perhaps we're beginning to move towards a therapeutic target. And on the subject of therapeutic targets, something very, very interesting. And this started by accident. So let me tell you a little bedtime or maybe a morning time story. Once upon a time in Germany, there was a patient with AIDS who also, well, HIV, he wasn't an AIDS patient, let me clarify. There was an HIV-positive patient who was being maintained on HIV drugs who got acute leukemia. And he was treated for his acute leukemia with a bone marrow transplant. Now, the donor was a person who was, well, a genetic mutant in a way, although that wasn't important. He was a healthy white male. He just happened to be missing the gene, both copies of the gene, for a protein receptor that's on the T cells. This protein receptor is called CCR5. And the HIV virus, the AIDS virus, needs CCR5 as a docking station, effectively, in order to get into the white blood cell. It has to grab onto the CCR5 and grab onto the CD4. When it's grabbed onto both of these proteins, it can open up the cell and get in and infect the cell. So if you don't have CCR5, the virus literally bounces off the white blood cell and can't infect it. Well, in this individual, the transplant actually caused him to have now new white blood cells that were CCR5 absent, and his HIV went away. This happened in 2009. It was reported. He's still alive. He's still doing well. It's astonishing. So researchers decided to try and see if they could make that happen in HIV patients. So this was announced just the other day, and what the scientists are working on is genetically engineering the CCR5 out of white blood cells. So the way this would work, if it becomes a real therapy, it'll be the first targeted gene therapy that I can think of that's being done in this fashion. They'll take your white blood cells out. They'll re-engineer them to remove the CCR5 so that the stem cells that are put back into you no longer have that gene. And then when those little stem cells make babies and make white blood cells, those white blood cells can't be infected with HIV. So the new white blood cells will be essentially bulletproof, and the HIV will gradually stop replicating and maybe fade away entirely. Maybe these cells won't last and you'll have to do repeat treatments. Maybe they'll have to maintain a separate cell culture. But the key point here is this isn't a bone marrow transplant from a donor. This is your own cells. And that means no anti-rejection drugs, no need to poison the bone marrow in order to replace it. So no heavy chemotherapy drugs. This could be a real, actual, and I'm putting it in quote marks, quote, cure, unquote. So stay tuned for this, but exciting stuff going on in the genetics and DNA world right now in science. So stay tuned. I'll be tweeting at AskDrDawn.com the reference for that New England Journal of Medicine article. Stay tuned for that, and I'll also post that on my Facebook, which is Ask Dr. Dawn. So getting the hang of all of this media stuff, and I'm always, always asking for feedback on how am I doing on this? What would you like to see? How would you like to see things roll out in this brave new world of internet? And let's clarify something. The Facebook and the Twitter are AskDrDawn with no period, just run through, not Dr. Spelled Out, although Dr. Spelled Out will get you to our website. Let's go to an email, and we had several very interesting emails this week. I want to read this one from Maria in Switzerland. Maria writes, "Believe it or not, I listen to your show while cross-country skiing. I store up podcasts and then usually listen two at a time. As winter is drawing to a close, I'm almost caught up. My question is about allergies. I have dry skin and periodic eczema on my ring finger. I wear my ring on the other hand. I also have hay fever in the spring for about 4 to 6 weeks. It used to be manageable. However, since I moved to Switzerland 3 years ago, it is close to unbearable. Blazing red eyes, itching fingers, eczema on my eyelids, sneezing and fatigue. Short of a 6-week vacation in the Caribbean every spring, what can I do? I take antihistamines, eye drops to soothe my eyes, have a mild cream to put on my eyelids, and use a hydrocortisone cream sparingly on my hand. I also watch what I eat so as not to get cross allergies or further aggravate the reactions." I want to emphasize, I think that's very intelligent of Maria. "I exercise indoors, which helps until the adrenaline wears off and the symptoms all come rushing back. I believe you previously mentioned Tagamet to block the H2 receptors. Is this right, and how much do I take? Are probiotics a good idea, or is it really what my doctor said, just grin and bear it? Signed, love to see the first tulips, but living in fear of the maelstrom to come. P.S. Healthy female, 50, no meds." So let's start with Maria's symptoms of red eyes and itchy fingers. So she's got both hay fever and she's got an underlying eczema. And something's fueling that eczema all year long. So she would be a candidate for doing an elimination diet. And I'll be sending my version of the elimination diet, which I got from the Institute for Functional Medicine, to Maria at her email. The next thing that crosses my mind is her question, are probiotics a good idea? And certainly they are an excellent idea. I want to emphasize an excellent, excellent idea. And I am particularly pointing her in the direction of Lactobacillus rhamosus, and that's with an R-H-A-M. That one has the best science behind using it to downregulate the allergic response. There are also some data that vitamin D may help to downregulate the allergic response, particularly to foods in the intestine. So making sure that your vitamin D levels are at least 40 would be a good idea. And that's 25 hydroxy vitamin D, Maria. Other things that can work for allergy in the natural world are quercetin, which is derived from apple skin. 300 to 400 milligrams a day seems to be pretty good for allergies. And then moving into the pharmaceutical world, the dose of Tagamet is 200 milligrams twice a day. That's an over-the-counter dose in the United States. Cimetidine is the trade name, the generic name. And I'm not sure if it's available over-the-counter in Switzerland, but I'm sure you can find that out. That is also very good for hives, and primarily that's where I use it is for hives, but it might also help with your itching, so it's worth a try. For your eyes, I want to mention something called Cromolyn, C-R-O-M-O-L-Y-N. Cromolyn down-regulates the mast cells so that they don't degranulate and release histamine and the other allergic compounds. All the leukotrienes, for example, come out of those mast cell granules. That's a really safe drug. As I like to say, I would dip a newborn baby in it with no qualms. It has to be used 3 or 4 times a day. Those eye drops are very safe for long-term use and very effective, so certainly look into getting those. And there is a oral monoleucast, is a oral leukotriene blocker. So if you're taking an antihistamine and you're still symptomatic, taking monoleucast or one of the other leukotriene antagonists, and I don't know what's available in Switzerland for you, would also be helpful. So, a long answer, but very topical, because we're heading into spring and allergy season, and I know there'll be other people out there needing to hear about that. One more email before we go to our callers. This one from Christine in Boulder Creek, who writes about her niece, Rose, who had a horrible car accident 17 months ago. I won't go into all of her injuries, but they were extreme. One of them was a ruptured small intestine, and 6 inches of her jejunum were removed. She then had a problem with healing her abdominal wound, and in fact, the wound opened up, and she had to be placed on a vacuum pump to keep the wound closed. And of course, through all this time, she would have been on high-dose antibiotics, and as to be expected, she contracted Clostridium difficile while in the hospital and had to take more antibiotics. Now, at the end of all of that, Rose is now able to walk, but she is having bouts of abdominal pain. She'll have a recurrence, perhaps weekly, where she'll have several days of severe abdominal pain, and all the king's horses and all the king's men have not been able to find a cause. So she's scheduled for abdominal surgery next month to go in and break up the adhesions that the doctors figure must be what's causing her symptoms. Christine wants to know what else might be doing it and if I had any suggestions. First of all, it's almost definite that Rose's bowel flora has been completely disrupted by this, and she needs to restore a normal set of bacterial colonies in her colon and small intestine. She could have the wrong bacteria growing up there in the small intestine. That area has been damaged and sewn back together, so it's going to have been very disrupted. It needs to be diagnosed, but a couple of things she can do while she's waiting for diagnosis. First of all, she should have a comprehensive stool study. There are multiple labs. There's Metamatrix, there's Genova that offer that. And Christine, if you'll contact me at my Mission Street office, which is optimagehealth.com, or go in through my website, askdrdon.com, if you contact me, I will put you in touch with these companies and help you obtain the appropriate testing, because there's time to do that. It's about 2 weeks. And if it turns out that she does have a severe dysbiosis and we can document that, then maybe putting off the surgery and treating the dysbiosis could potentially save her from having to have surgery for a problem that is not a surgical issue, but in standard medicine, surgery is what we have to offer at this point. Secondly, because part of her jejunum was removed, she will be missing some of her ability to absorb certain nutrients, and she'll be missing her enzymes to break down sugars. So taking a digestive enzymes that has a lot of disaccharidases. These are enzymes that break down carbohydrates, may help a lot. And so that should be done soon. Those can be obtained at health food stores. And I would especially go off all dairy, because that's the part of the intestine, the small intestine, where dairy is broken down. And if she has now developed food sensitivities because she cannot break down complex carbohydrates, it could be manifesting with that sort of pain when she eats a lot of a certain kind of carbohydrate that she can't break down. That needs to be thought of and checked. And a therapeutic trial of enzymes would be how I would go after that one. There are other ways. And the comprehensive stool analysis will give us some idea of whether she's developed other digestive deficiencies as a result of her surgery and all of the antibiotics. So let me thank you very much for asking that. And let's see if we can't help out Rose. And now we're going to see if we can help out Diane in Seaside. Welcome to the show.
How are you doing?
Good.
Good. I'm calling on behalf of my mother, who's 86, and she has neuropathy in her one of her legs and her right leg.
Is she diabetic?
Well, so far in her life, she hasn't been, but we are getting ready to do a diabetes test.
Okay. The source of the neuropathy, any idea?
Other than her having some small fractures in her lower vertebrae, that's the only thing I can imagine.
So she doesn't have like a history of disc disease or something like that?
No.
Okay. All right, go ahead with your question.
So my question is, her doctors haven't really been able to do much about it. I'm wondering about acupuncture, and I have contacted an acupuncturist who has said that she often treats it, but I just called to ask you what your opinion was of acupuncture for neuropathy.
Well, I don't know the protocol that the acupuncturist that your mother is considering using uses. So I'm okay, go ahead. Yes.
T-U-I-N-A, okay. Acupressure, myofascial release, and herbs, as well as she recommends taking folic acid, B-complex, and fish oil.
All right. So a little bit about neuropathy before I answer your question. There are several different types of neuropathy. There's compression neuropathy, which is where something's pushing on the nerve, and that's where the fracture comes in, or disc disease, or things like that. And those neuropathies tend to be asymmetric. In other words, most of the time, they're much more strongly on one side of the body than the other. They're structural, and it's, you know, unlikely the structure breaks down symmetrically. The other type of neuropathy is metabolic. And the metabolic neuropathies are diabetes, syphilis, which is neurosyphilis, and vitamin deficiencies and unknown. So those tend to be symmetric and more or less affect both sides of the body to the same degree. They also have a different distribution pattern in that the compression neuropathies usually are more of a stripe up the side of the body, kind of like a zebra. If you imagine a human on all fours and put zebra stripes on the human, the neuropathy will be along a zebra stripe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if it's nutritional, obviously the blood goes everywhere, it will be more like the farthest part of the body. So if you imagine a sock and you're pulling a sock on, you pull it over the toe, then you pull it over the midfoot, then you get it over the ankle, and then you pull it up your leg. And so the neuropathy tends to come up the body like a stocking comes up the leg.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to distinguish between the two, because the therapies, naturally because the causes are different, the therapies are different.
Well, as you explain that, I'm thinking it's more the compression neuropathy, because it is only on one side, and it's in her foot up part of the lower half of her leg.
Yes, that would be more consistent with a compression neuropathy for sure. And naturally, the treatment's a little bit different depending on what you're treating. I don't have a lot of experience with, and I think it's pronounced tweena rather than tuna, but I might be wrong about that. And if an acupuncturist wants to call in and tell us how it's pronounced, that would be great. But that therapy is not something I've used personally in my practice, so I can't speak to how effective it is. But I am an acupuncturist as well and do treat neuropathy, and my success rate's about 50% for the metabolic ones and about 75% for the compression neuropathies. And I think that has to do with just the mechanism and the type of treatment I'm doing, which is working on getting the spinal cord to rewire itself using a technique called Craig Pens. I'm going to spell that out. It's like the name Craig, C-R-A-I-G, and then capital initials P-E-N-S, which stands for percutaneous electrical nerve stimulation. And this is actually a trademarked therapeutic maneuver. You can Google that, and there, I'm sure it has a web page and lots of information. And I found it to be remarkably effective for compression neuropathies. And so that's my go-to treatment for that kind of problem. So I think that acupuncture is always worthwhile whenever you're dealing with a nervous system issue. There's an intimate connection between the nervous system and the way, whatever we're doing, messing with the chi, releasing neurohumoral components that haven't been identified, affecting who knows what. There's so many different hypotheses about what acupuncture is. And it all depends on where you're standing, right? That's the three blind men and the elephant. But whatever, all three blind men agree that it's a thing, it's alive, and it's moving. And so I would say try the acupuncture, this that you've talked to. Don't necessarily give up if the first type of acupuncture doesn't succeed, because, again, the guy at the back end of the elephant may not necessarily be able to figure out how it's breathing.
Okay, well, that is good information, and I'm hoping she'll proceed without chickening out.
Good, and thank you to the acupuncturist who just called in and said it's pronounced Twaina, T-W-A-Y-N-A is the phonetic spelling that Charlie's just given me, Twaina. Well, thank you for the call.
Thanks, Dr. Don.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So we have another email from Shirley in Pacific Grove about burning on the bottoms of her feet. Shirley is 78, and she has insulin resistance, which she's controlling with diet, exercise, cinnamon, and mustard. Mustard's a new one on me. I'll have to read up on that. She has burning on the bottoms of her feet and has been using 400 milligrams of alpha-lipoic acid to control glucose. And she's wondering about increasing the ALA up to 800. As far as we know, yes, you can take ALA at 800 milligrams. I would take it 400 twice a day. But one important caveat, Shirley, if you're taking ALA, it can deplete the body levels of biotin, which is one of the B vitamins. So it's imperative that you be taking a B-complex vitamin, which you should be anyway if you have neuropathy. And it's also important to get your B12 levels checked. And the B12 levels need to be at least 500, or you should supplement. Because if you have low B12, it makes you more vulnerable to the neuropathy that diabetes can produce. And you're not really that diabetic, so you may have a combination neuropathy. And, of course, the older we get, the more we see neuropathy. And it's one of those things that at the moment we doctors sort of say, well, you're 78, you've got neuropathy, what else is new? You're just getting older. What that means is we have no idea what the root cause of this neuropathy is, so we're attributing it to aging. But the longer I live and the more I practice medicine, the more I realize when something is a truth and when something is an ignorance. And in the case of why older people get neuropathy, that's a medical ignorance. And maybe it is about B12, or maybe it's about a combination of nutritional deficiencies, or maybe it's something else completely, and maybe it's treatable. So stay tuned, because it's an important issue. Let's do one more email, and then we'll go to the phones. This to Peggy in Moss Landing. Peggy wants to know about taking nitroglycerin for bone mass, and she's wondering if she gets a headache, if she should take niacin to counter it. And the answer is, Peggy, we have no data, and for me, that doesn't really make sense. The headache related to nitroglycerin is not most likely from constriction of the blood vessels, but rather from dilation of the blood vessels. So just like migraine, it's when the blood vessels open up that you get the pain. So niacin, which increases blood flow, I don't see how it could possibly help, and it might actually make it worse. Let's go now to Jean in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jean, and welcome to the show.
I always enjoy your show when I'm home to listen to it, and I've learned a lot from it.
But thank you.
I've been thinking about something lately, and I thought maybe you could answer.
Okay.
I went to Catholic school. I was, I think, originally left-handed, but in Catholic schools in those days...
Oh, those nuns.
Yeah, those nuns would not allow it. I mean, with physical punishment. So I was forced to use my right hand.
How old were you when you started Catholic school?
Probably 5 or 6.
Okay, so you still had a lot of neurologic plasticity, and they basically trained you into being ambidextrous.
They forced us.
Well, it's training, right?
Okay, it's training, yeah. All right.
Training is a less emotionally charged word.
right. But, well, of course, I used my right hand, had horrible handwriting, but it did help when we had to do all those little squiggly things, you know, the barbed wire and the Tootsie Rolls and all that.
Yes.
I could do all that. But I have always had difficulty handwriting. If I'm left alone, which I seldom do, of course, write letters or anything, I write with a backhand. I mean, a definite slanted backhand.
Do you mean you use your left hand?
No, my right hand.
You use your right hand, but
yeah.
You slant to the left.
Yes.
How interesting. Go ahead.
And I know that I'm ambidextrous because I do a lot of things with my left hand also. So the computer, of course, is a lifesaver. I'd never write a letter if a computer hadn't been invented. My right hand is painful. I can feel the pain in my right hand when I try to write.
Mm-hmm.
I usually end up either back slant or I write straight up and down, and then people can read it. If I just try to scrawl toward the right, it's undecipherable.
I have an experiment to propose to you.
All right.
Okay. The experiment is to start with drawing and use your left hand. Begin drawing using your left hand, and then go get, and I'm sure you can buy this at an old bookstore or probably pull it off the internet, but go get one of those old, after you've drawn for a while, say, 15, 20 minutes a day for a week, go get one of those old handwriting books that teach you how to do handwriting. And don't approach it as letters. I mean, don't approach it as words. Approach it as drawing pictures of the letters with your left hand.
Well, where would I find these old photos?
I would try penmanship or search calligraphy. Calligraphy might work.
Online, you mean?
Yeah, and see if you can find some instructions for calligraphy, or you could do tanji, which is, I believe that's how you pronounce it, the Chinese calligraphy. And so, but do it with your left hand. So what you're doing is approaching it not as words, but approaching it as movement and learning to let your left hand do it. Kind of practice it up, wake up those nerve cells that are in there anyway and are the natural predisposition. Then after you've practiced a little bit and you feel confident making the shapes of the letters, then try to handwrite with your left hand and see if you can teach yourself to write with your left hand. It's the natural tendency of your brain. And I'm just thinking it'd be a wonderful experiment to see how that worked for you. If you practice it as drawing first, you'll sneak up on your brain. That's why I'm suggesting treating it first as drawing, because the part of your brain that thinks of it as language is going to block the free flow of movement otherwise. But if you approach it as drawing, kind of sneak it in, then go from drawing to drawing pictures of the letters, then you may be able to just, even at an advanced adult age, move back to using your left hand. It would be fascinating to see how that worked for you.
Well, I do a lot of drawing, but right-handed, of course.
Yeah, switch hands.
All right.
But switch hands.
Switch hands and try. Now, that has something to do, yeah, I've read about that, awakening up your abilities and all that with
no,
the left side.
Well, yes and no. You see, you're wired differently than the average person. You were just born that way. That's what left-handedness is. They trained you to write with your right hand, and you got some rewiring because you can do it. But what I'm saying is that the natural bias might be left-handed, and you feel that pushing against the natural tendency. That's why you're having the hand pain, and it's difficult.
Oh, I see. Sure, I figured that.
So go with the flow. Instead of trying to swim upstream, reverse it, and then try to re-educate. So it's like if you were an adult who had never learned to write, and we were teaching you to write, you could still learn that. So what you're doing is you're in this case, one part of your brain, and I'm not sure where it lives because people who are left-handed are wired differently, but one part of your brain, the part that knows how to write words, has been used to controlling the right hand, but that part of the brain could also take over and control the left hand, but you have to sneak up on the brain.
Oh, I see. So it would be the part of the brain controls both the right and the left?
It can in you.
Uh-huh.
In most other people, it's not like that. But in you, it will be like that.
It'll be interesting to find out.
Precisely. It'll be fascinating. It'll be fun.
I'm willing to try it.
Besides, it'll probably stave off Alzheimer's for a few years. All that brain rewiring will release lots of VEGF, which is vascular epithelial growth factor, which exercise also releases, by the way.
Oh, I do a lot of exercise.
Good. Your nerve cells will sprout new connections and be very happy.
Oh, and they might be smarter.
Well, let's just say you'll stay as smart as you are longer.
That's the deal. All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
You're
Bye.
Welcome. And we did have a caller call in and suggest a book which has been in print forever called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. I remember buying a copy of that when I was in college, lo these many years. So, yes, indeed, that is an excellent book and something for our audience. Let's go now to Dave in Santa Cruz. Hello, Dave, and welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you. So, okay, first of all, I'm a runner. I've been a runner pretty much my entire life. 9 years ago, I had a torn meniscus in my right knee, and I was really reluctant to have surgery, and I lived with it for about a year and a half. And so finally, I had surgery, and boom, the problem just disappeared. It was an amazingly successful surgery.
Well, now how many years ago did you have surgery?
It was about 8 years ago.
Okay, go ahead.
So now I have the same issue in my left knee. I tore the meniscus in my left knee. And even though the surgery was a success, I really don't want to have surgery again. I mean, I can live with it. The pain is manageable. And I'm just wondering if you think there are any alternatives to having the surgery.
When did you first injure the left knee? How long ago?
It's been about 3 weeks.
Okay. And you've had an MRI already?
No. Okay. I mean, I know it's a meniscus because it is the exact same pain as I had that I lived with for a year and a half.
Let me say that the probability is high that it's a meniscus, but I'm not urging you to get an MRI. There are things that can be done on physical exam that will confirm that, but let's take it for the purposes of this discussion that you have a confirmed meniscal tear.
Okay.
The natural history of these is that when the cartilage tears, the meniscus being a roughly donut-shaped ring of cartilage that sits on the top of the flat plane of the tibial and holds the big balls of the femur in place and keeps them from jiggling too much, and the cartilage wears out, degenerates, and splits and cracks. When the cartilage cracks, it generates the release of a lot of inflammatory chemicals, and those inflammatory chemicals float around, inflame the joint, make it hurt, and cause pain. So if you did nothing back before we had meniscal surgery, what would happen most of the time is that you would have 6 to 8 weeks of pain, and it would gradually get better, sort of like a sprained ankle, gradually get better until it wasn't painful except when you move a certain way that pushes directly on the crack.
Mm-hmm.
And most people would spontaneously improve and be left with maybe a slight, you know, pain when it's going to rain and pain when they twist a certain way, but otherwise not in any way disabled or inconvenienced.
I can relate to all of that because of what happened on the right side.
Right. So now that we have surgery, there is just an enormous commercial bias towards getting the study and getting the surgery and hurry up and do it. And it's really, honest to God, it's in some places, it's hurry up and do it before the patient gets better and decides they don't want surgery. Now, about somewhere between 25% and 10%, and I don't have, you know, that's, I'm pulling that out of the air. I'm not citing any studies, but it seems to me that about somewhere around between a quarter to a tenth of the time, the patients don't get enough better. And at the 3 month mark, if the person has not improved significantly and isn't on the path to recovery, that's when I send them off to get the MRI and see the surgeon. Now, the exception to that is if they're having the kind of dysfunction that puts them at risk, which is to say the knee is locking or the knee is collapsing.
No.
And if you have either of those, you have to get surgery because you could fall crossing the street and be run over. So you really should have surgery under those circumstances, and those don't usually heal. But I always urge a course of healing, and while you're trying to heal, a cortisone injection into the knee to calm down the inflammation makes a lot of sense. And I have personally stopped a lot of people from getting surgery by giving them that cortisone injection to get them through to the 3 month mark.
Okay.
because you're in pain and you want to get it fixed. And we're a society that we view our body like a car. And when I started practicing medicine, I used to use car metaphors all the time. And then as I learned more about the body and about the human mind and about natural medicine, I found myself using mechanical metaphors less and less frequently.
Okay. So I continue to run, and it really doesn't bother me that much when I run. It's like other random times, exactly as you said, certain positions, certain things may make it hurt.
Turn and starting and stopping, turning and pivoting. So running hurts a lot less than ballroom dancing would.
Okay.
Or book dancing, you know, where you're going back and forth. And twisting and spinning. Yeah. Those are the things that will hurt the knee.
Okay. And so I guess my main question would be, is this going to set me up for a painful arthritic condition when I get older?
Either way, you're not going to make any difference in your arthritis whether you do surgery or not. That's well established.
Really?
Yeah, it sucks. But 10 years out, whether you do the meniscal surgery or you don't do the meniscal surgery, the incidence of arthritis is the same.
Wow, okay.
I know, it helps your pain now, but it doesn't prevent arthritis later.
Okay.
And they will try to sell it to you on the basis of that, and there is scientific evidence to the contrary, good quality data. So,
okay. Well, when I did the right one several years ago, I went to 6 different surgeons before I finally decided on, okay, this guy I trust. And I just don't want to go through that whole thing again.
Well, you've identified a surgeon, and I would say, why don't you give it 3 months?
Okay.
And see what your recovery curve is. Don't assume it's going to replicate your experience on the right.
Okay.
Let that demonstrate itself. And, you know, if you get to 3 months and it's like, this is not getting better and it's bothering me enough to be worth the surgery, then go ahead and go there. It will get rid of the problem, but it will not prevent long-term arthritis.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're awesome. You're very welcome. Bye-bye. Let's go to Debbie in Monterey. Hello, Debbie. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for taking some time. My question, let me give you a little history, is regarding my son who has ulcerative pancolitis.
Oh, dear. How old is your son, Debbie?
He's now 31, and he's had it for 3 years.
Okay.
Diagnosed 3 years ago. I'm sure he had it before then, in his 20s, but we didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was officially diagnosed via a colonoscopy.
Yes.
And so we've been battling that with him. And the history on what we've been trying, of course, we started first by looking at his diet, and we got him off gluten, got him off dairy, and then that didn't. It seemed to maybe help a little, but he kept getting flares every 3 months or so. And they put him on the mesalamine, I think it is.
Right.
And that, on high doses of that. And we don't know if that really did anything, but he's on that for a year or two. And then that wasn't working. He kept getting them. Then they put him on the prednisone on top of the mesalamine. Mm-hmm. And then that wasn't working. And so within the last year, he went on Imuran, I think it's called. And he had a bad reaction to that, very bad on his liver, and so they took him off that right away, and now he's on infusions of Remicade, and so he's had two months of the infusions on top of being on prednisone at the same time. They've been weaning him off of the prednisone. He's down to his third infusion that he's going to have in March 14th. At that point, he will also be off of the prednisone. So where we're at now is wait and see. They said they'll give him the third infusion coinciding with taking him off the prednisone, and then he won't have any more infusions for 8 weeks. And in that 8-week period, they say that's it should show up whether this Remicade is in fact working or not. They really can't say.
Mm-hmm.
He did not have any kind of allergic reaction at the site.
Okay, so what is your question? I've got the background now. And
okay,
so what
the question is, after he's had his third infusion and the prednisone is off, if he flares again, that I guess is good. The next thing is what they're saying is that they would have to go to surgery and take out his colon.
Right.
Would you concur to that or with that?
Well, I'm not in a position to second-guess the managing doctors on the basis of a phone conversation, so I can't answer it that way. But I would point you to a couple of things. First of all, there is an interview in my archives. I believe it's 2009. You can go to askdrdawn.com, and that's D-R or doctor, spelled out, and go into the archives, click the interviews, and look for Gerard Mullen, M-U-L-L-I-N. And so the Gerard Mullen interview, he is a gastroenterologist who uses all of these drugs for colitis, but he also uses some natural medicine techniques. And some of them are pretty cutting edge. Some of them are amazing. While you're on, your son is on these heavy drugs, it might be a good time to start instituting some of these preventative natural methods like the Boswellia and the probiotics and things like that to try and keep his symptoms from coming back. The other thing I would say is make sure they've checked his vitamin D levels and that they're up at least at 45 or 50, because that is helpful directly for the integrity of the bowel wall, which he really needs. He should be using glutamine, and he should be using probiotics, and he should be using prebiotics so that his bowel wall can heal. And that's very important because, you know, the cells themselves that are going to divide to cover back up the sores that are inside his colon need nourishment, need nutrition in order to do that. And often a person's on a fairly restricted diet and they may not be getting that nutrition. So you want to directly feed the cells that you're expecting to grow. So there's a lot of gardening and nurturing things that aren't done by conventional medicine that might fit in here. And they're discussed very well, very eloquently by Dr. Mullen. So I would urge you to go and listen to that interview and maybe download it and give it to your son to give to his doctors, because there's nothing objectionable in there to a gastroenterologist. And this guy has the kind of professional credentials that will make a gastroenterologist stand up and take notice, because he's not a flake and he's not selling vitamins, which if you are selling vitamins, conventional medicine just dismisses you as a hack. There's no consideration of anything you have to say. It's unfortunate because I think there are a lot of people who are saying really good things who are also selling vitamins, but that's a different conversation.
How do you spell his name, Gerard Mullen?
M-U-L-L-I-N. Gerard, J-E-R-A-R-D. Yeah. Well, let me tell you, it's June 13th, 2009 is the interview.
Okay.
So you can...
June 13th.
Right. So you can go look that up. He's at somewhere in Baltimore, I think. Johns Hopkins, I think, is where he's at, or somewhere in the East Coast. I don't remember what his university is off the top of my head.
Can I ask a question in regards to, would it be better for my son, because he is on some vitamins, and I don't know that he's on glutamine, or I think he is on probiotics. Prebiotics. I'm not sure. I know the difference.
Right, but you can find that out. Go ahead. What's the question?
Would it be more efficient for his colon to be taking, like, liquid vitamins? Would he be able to absorb better than the regular pill kind?
Probably doesn't make any difference. Most of the absorption is going to take place in the small intestine, not in the large intestine, as far as everything but the glutamine. So yeah, you can probably do that with the prebiotics are the stuff that the probiotics ferment. It's food, basically, bacteria chow. And it's what they ferment into something called short chain fatty acids, which are what the colonocytes eat. So you're trying to feed the colon cells by using the prebiotics and the probiotics.
Okay, I had one other question that's on the same line. I did hear some information from a doctor in UCSF. It's a new kind of a treatment that they discovered, but it has not been FDA approved. It has to do with ingesting parasitic eggs.
Right.
Dr. Loki.
Right. This is, it's pork whipworm, I believe. It's a form, it's a roundworm. It doesn't grow in the human intestinal tract. So, no, let me rephrase that. It does grow in the human intestinal tract, and it seems to work by retraining the immune system, so the immune system stops attacking itself. And the mechanism of that is complex. We won't get into it. It's very controversial, outlawed in the United States. I've personally talked with people who are doing it, and I've talked with one of the practitioners who provides it. I'm not advocating that therapy. I think when people are in an extreme situation, they'll go for extreme things. And I'm still on the fence on that one, but I'm open to hearing more. I'm open to seeing the people who are treating that way build a case record of success and get it reconsidered. Once there's a success rate, it starts to get looked at again and studied. I think it's very promising, but it's experimental therapy, and I'm not ready to advocate for experimental therapy at this point for the general public. In your son's case, he's awfully sick. he's just awfully, awfully sick. And he does need to be managed by experts. And I don't want to say it's too late to help him. It's never too late. But he's got a lot of momentum in a very bad direction. And pulling back from that momentum is going to be difficult. And natural therapy alone may not be strong enough at this late stage in the game. It can't hurt. It can't hurt.
Is there any way that you would be able to give me who has used this therapy, this Paracivic one, the name of a doctor who...
There's no local doctor doing it. I'm not aware of anyone in the United States doing it.
Oh, okay, but you said you knew someone who...
I do, and they go to Europe. If you want to know more about this, I'll tell you what I know, but I'm not going to tell you on the air because I'm not ready to advocate for this. And if I put it out here to the general public, then that constitutes advocacy, and I don't want to go there. All right. My contact information is there. I'll talk to you via email, okay?
Okay, and it's Dr. D-O-N?
D-A-W-N. Ask Dr. Dawn, D-A-W-N.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's talk to Doug in Santa Cruz. Hello, Doug. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Dr. Dawn. How are you today?
I'm good. Okay. What can I do for you?
I wanted to get right to this because I know we don't have much time, but I wanted to get a blood test. And I wanted to find out what you were talking about. I have problems gaining weight. I'm a vegetarian, although I do eat some dairy. And I take probiotics and I take enzymes and I exercise. And you said that there was something called an HSCRP or something like that?
That's right. It stands for High Sensitivity C-Reactive Protein. And it's a marker for inflammation in the body. We know that high levels of inflammation, if the level is above about 10, it's a strong predictor for heart disease. It's stronger than cholesterol as far as saying, you know, if you have a HSCRP above 10 and it stays that way, your probability of having a heart attack in the next 10 years or the next 5 years, anyway, the predictive value of that number is much better than the predictive value of a high cholesterol. And it's just becoming into consciousness, although it's...
Is there another one that goes with that? HCP?
I don't know what HCP is.
I don't know either. So it's just the HS...
High Sensitivity C-Reactive Protein, the initials for that. And that's the one that is currently being used as a risk factor, and it definitely can be shifted with diet if you eat fish oils and healthy oils and stay away from sugar. You will see that HSCRP drop in people just by diet alone.
Okay. Now, another thing is I have slight osteopenia.
Mm-hmm. So what? Osteopenia is not a disease. It means that somebody did a bone scan on you and you were below average on bone density. It doesn't have much predictive value at the level of osteopenia. You may always have had osteopenia. You may never have had more bone than you've got right now. If you've only got one data point, you don't know that. So I don't treat osteopenia, and I think we've got a manufactured disease there. Osteoporosis is a different story. When the bones get thin enough that you are two standard deviations from the average healthy bone, then you're in trouble. But one standard deviation or half a standard deviation, which would slight osteopenia is probably half a standard deviation, that's like a bell curve. It doesn't mean anything.
It's in my neck, and I had a neck injury.
So?
Would that relate to one another? Not necessarily.
It's a non-issue.
Okay.
It's a non-issue.
I have, on my last blood and, what do they call it, metabolic, I had high uric nitrogen.
BUN, blood urea nitrogen. You might have just been dehydrated when that test was done.
Well, this has been consistent since 1996.
Okay, so the way to look at the BUN is you take the BUN and then you look for the other number, the creatinine.
Yes.
And what's your creatinine?
The creatinine was slightly high.
Mm-hmm. They tend to run together. So if both of them are high, then what that indicates is a problem with kidney function. So you may have suboptimal kidney function.
Okay.
The way to test that accurately is to get a 24-hour urine specimen for protein and creatinine. And then they measure your creatinine clearance. And that is the best way to look at what is this person's kidney function. Is it really high? Is it really low? Or is the BUN elevated for one of the other reasons, which I won't go into, that can cause it to be high? But getting your kidney function assessed accurately is now important for you.
Okay.
We have to go now, so I won't have time for any more questions, but thank you for the call.
Thank you very much for your help.
You're welcome. Thank you for listening, and to my entire audience out there, you can follow me on Twitter at AskDrDawn, or you can go to Ask Dr. Dawn on Facebook, or you can go to my website. I post links, and I'm starting to blog about, well, healthcare and science in the news. What else? This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.